accession number 14238, reel 4.
Mr. Gower, reel 4.
Commander Aches, he used to be in charge of the U-boats when they came back over to, I think it was an island, or came back into British British sphere.
Now, after the Sea Nymph, I think that you went to the Far East in the Tiptoe.
Yeah.
Can you tell me how that came about?
Yes, I went through for... I volunteered to leave the Sea Nymph because I wanted to go through for LTO, Lead Torpedo Operator. Now, our torpedo gunner's mate came down the boat one day and he was half sozzled. And he talked to two or three of us in the boat. And then he turned round to me and I thought I was in for a bit of a rollicking. And he said, "And you," he said, "let me say this, you are the most efficient and the most experienced seaman torpedoman," he said, "I've ever come across." That was like music to my ears, because I'd wanted to go through for an LTO, and in fact it was on the it was the Sea Nymph that recommended me for leading torpedo operator.
You left the Sea Nymph in December 43, we should say.
Yeah. Went down to Eastbourne to do my leading torpedo operator course. And I used to come home every day. One wonders how one can afford the money and the time, but I used to sit dozing in the classroom. It seemed that whenever I went home to London, my daughter would start crying as a baby when I walked to the house and stopped when I walked out. And I used to catch the paper train back to Eastbourne at 3:25 every morning and go and sit in the classroom for the rest of the day. All the time that I was at Eastbourne, I never found time to see the beach. We used to do, or we were billeted in Pennell House at Eastbourne College. And it gave me a few frighteners. I saw a depth charge there, which was a 2,000 pounder. And I began to think I was in the wrong trade. Anyway, when I successfully finished the course, I went back to Dolphin, and I was sweeping a couple of matchsticks up in the parade ground. I'd been pushing it around for a couple of hours, these couple of matchsticks. And a voice behind me said to me, "Hello, Gower," he said, "what are you doing here?" So I said, "Well, to tell you the truth," I said, "I'm fault party," I said, "I've been pushing these matchsticks along for hours." say, he said, what? He said, an experienced person, he said, like you. He said, why are you in a boat? So I said, well, I've just finished my lead to winter operators course. So he said, well, he said, I've got the roll call. He said, would you come with me out to the Far East?
Who was this?
Commander Oakley. He was a Lieutenant Oakley at the time, commander now. He was the skipper of the Royal War, got out to the forest. And when I spoke to him after the war, he said to me the Royal War was the only mine layer that had survived the war. I said to him, well, sir, I said, I've got the wife up in Fairham. I said, she stopped me with her aunt. I said, and I'll see what she says. But the arrangement was that if the wife had said it was okay, she would I would rather put a note through his door and he would arrange about getting me aboard Royal Corps, because as he said, of all his crew, there was only two of them that had ever done patrols, and neither of them were LTOs. He said, I've got a boat of innocence. I spoke to the wife and I said, what Lieutenant Oakley had said. And she said to me, well, Alf, look, he said, you've been volunteering time after time and you've been lucky. She said, now, no more volunteering. If it comes, it comes. But don't volunteer anymore. So I thought, well, it was about time. I did knuckle down a bit, and I left a note with Lieutenant Oakley expressing my regrets. I was then going up into the mess deck. And a voice was bellowing away, a chap complaining about the rum. And he couldn't get anybody to go with him to make a complaint. Because he said it had been watered down too much. Now, I didn't drink rum. It was too water anyway that they got in the depots, but I was a non-drinker, so I didn't drink the rum. I used to give it away. Anyway, I said to him, no, I said, I'm not interested. He said, all will come up here is for my dinner. I said, I don't worry about rum. He said, well, he said, I thought you would at least come and help me to complain. He said, these other so-and-sos, he said, gutless so-and-so, as they're saying, they won't complain about it. So the gun layer Voisey, DSM, came with me and we complained about the rum. The officer said, no, that hadn't been touched, that rum hadn't been watered down in excess. He said, but we noticed the next day it was a bit stronger. I'm going to skip a point here, and I'm going to the tiptoe, and I'm sitting opposite Guns Boise. We were both eating our dinner, and I said to him, "You blessed so-and-so," and I swore at him. He looked up at me smilingly. He said, "Boy," he said, "what's the matter?" I said, "You and I," I said, "we complained about the rum." I said, "and here we are now, heading for the Far East."
So you think that you were put on it deliberately?
May have been, I don't know.
What was the voyage out to the Far East like?
I found it all right. What we did, we pulled into Malta. We was only there for a couple of days, a few runs ashore. And from Malta, we went through the Suez. We stopped for a few hours at Ismailia. Then through the Red Sea to Bombay.
This sounds like the summer of 44.
Yeah.
Was it the time of D-Day?
No, it was a bit before D-Day. It was a bit before D-Day. And from Bombay, we went down to what was then Ceylon. Now, of course, we're named Sri Lanka, and then round to Trincomalee. Our first patrol at Trincomalee was to go through the Andaman Islands territory, because it was expected that there was going to be a big raid. A big aircraft raid. And we were going to pick up any survivors from the aircraft in case they jettisoned. After that patrol, we came back to Trincomalee. On another patrol, we used to patrol off Rangoon, and incidentally, that gave me the Burma Star, a future medal. And then we set sail. Perth Fremantle. Coming out of Fremantle, we used to go through the Lombok Straits out into the Indian Ocean, coming up into the China Seas. And we used to go for shipping round by that area. Now, I was an experienced submariner. I was on an LTO. I was an LTO, which meant that I used to sort of drive the submarine when it was underneath the water. I used to do the charging of the batteries when we were on the surface, and my action station was the motor room, again for surfacing and diving. in between of that, of course, there was the batteries to be tested. And this was a part of the lead torpedo operator's duties. I'd come away from torpedoes because, like all big organisations, if you get on top of your job, they move you. And as I say, I used to be on the driver to submarines instead of torpedoes. I used to like torpedoes. I used to love torpedoes and explosives and all the lot of it, but at this occasion it was on the main motors. We did about three patrols out in the Far East. One of them, we travelled about 7,000 miles. And because, as I said, I was an experienced mariner, I did not like being on the surface. On one occasion, the old guns buoy was fired away at some ships. It sank a few of them, and the klaxons started bleating out, and we started to dive. Now, when I started to dive, although there was a routine amount of revs to keep to, I always used to give it that little bit more to get down faster. Two destroyers that came round the headlands, and they started depth charging us. Quite a few close ones, and the Tiptoe was out of action for 24 hours, and water was coming in. The depth charges that came down, they knocked the caulking off the tanks. There was bulbs breaking, and we were treading around in glass. And a depth charge will fall 8 feet a second. We were only in 50 feet of water, and the chap in the ASDIC gear, with the ASDIC gear, he started reporting, you see, that the destroyer had stopped, was coming in, dropping depth charges, and away again. And we were getting pretty nervous down below, and I prayed for the first time. I said, "It, that's my wife. I've been a bit of a basket in my time, but if I ever get out of this, I shall never go astray again." That was my prayer. One of the destroyers, you could hear its propellers going right above us, and I counted 6 seconds. But I counted 6 seconds too fast. "Thank Christ," I shouted, "he's missed us." And then the depth charge fell, and the boat shuddered all over the show. And by a bit of luck, we got out of that one.
Where was that?
In the Javanese waters. The other side of the log box. Indonesia, isn't it now?
Dutch East Indies.
Yeah. So, you know. So, I've had quite a few close incidents in my life. Depth charged, shelled, bombed.
Did you ever take any prisoners aboard in the Tiptoe?
No. That would become a that would never become a feasibility as regards to taking prisoners, because you never know what damage they can do. Submariners, you see, in the parent ship, there was a signal put up. Now, usually, I took down different notices, and this one said that we should never allow ourselves to be captured because the Japanese considered us as pirates and they would chop your arms and legs off and throw you back into the sea. Now, because of the seriousness of that message, I did take it down. The Tiptoe.
You mean you took the notice down?
I usually took them notice down, yeah, keep them as keepsakes. But that one I wouldn't do because it's serious. The Tiptoe, in concert with Trump, sank the last Japanese ship of the war.
How did it happen? Can you describe it?
Well, no, because don't forget I was in a motor room all the time. You see, but going back over the records, Captain S at the time was Ben Bryan, and he said that this was one of the most daring feats that had ever been
carried out
by British submarines. At one time we were stuck on the bottom and couldn't move, but as I say, we're only a 50-foot water.
What were living conditions like in the tropics?
Well, it was hot. It was really hot. And I was in a kind of a job where I didn't go out as lookout anymore because of the job that I had to do, i.e. made motors. When we used to go swimming in Ceylon, I say Ceylon because at the time it was called Ceylon. I used to go swimming in a baby's hat to keep the sun off the head, a Newcastle football jersey to keep the sun off the back, and a pair of boots because the sun was so hot. And the weather wasn't too bad, didn't really affect us. I liked Australia. I did ask the wife if she would emigrate with me, but she said no, it's too far away from her parents, so we didn't go. Anyway, on reflection, perhaps it would have been rather useless going out there, because I'm sure that she wouldn't have lasted as long as she did had she gone out.
People quite often ask us at the museum about the effects on family life of people being in the services in war, because they seem to feel that nowadays soldiers and so on getting traumatised, families break up because of their menfolk coming back having seen mutilated bodies and so on. How did being in the Royal Navy in the Second World War affect your family life?
My wife knew that I wasn't frightened of anything at the time. Psychologically, because of my upbringing, I didn't have too much to worry about, and I never worried about too much. But the most frightening thing that ever happened to me it affected me. I was doing my submarine training of an evening when I was on watch. I used to do a stint guarding Asda Hospital. The red warning was on that invasion is imminent. And I heard the rustle in the bushes, the scrub that used to be opposite Asda Hospital, built up now, of course. I shouted out, "Halt, who goes there?" No reply. "Halt, who goes there?" No reply. "Halt!" And I stuck my bayonet right forward as fast as I could. And I stopped 4 inches away from a little baby's head. The baby was about 2 years of age. And I spoke to the child. I was trembling. And then there was another rustle. A woman came out carrying another child. And I said to her, "Mrs., I almost killed your child. Why?" So she said, well, she said, "We were running to get in the shelters underneath the hospital. And I told the boy to run ahead.